Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, Lord.
Hello, welcome back to The Breakdown, week 54, episode 54 in a collector series. This week, we have a great question. It comes via email from Jacob D. of Atlanta, Georgia. It's a long question. I'm going to read it in full because I think it's so well phrased, and then we're going to get into the answer. Okay, Jacob D. from Atlanta, Georgia writes, quote, we know from 2008 that the absolute implosion of a financial institution can wreak havoc on the larger economy. But often when financial or other reforms are proposed, such as facilitating more mortgage modifications, we hear that if we reduce the performance of financial institutions and financial markets, we will also harm the larger economy, even though the larger society doesn't seem to share in the benefits when financial institutions and markets thrive. Excluding 2008-style cataclysms, to what degree is the welfare of the productive economy and the middle and working class hostage to the performance of financial institutions and financial markets, and can that be changed? Okay, well, that's a really big question you could write an entire book about. You could probably write several volumes about that question, but we're going to try to tackle it in somewhat abbreviated form today with my guest, Mike Konzel. Hopefully you are reading, Mike, and if you are not, after listening to this podcast, you're going to want to. Mike Konzel is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He blogs at New Deal 2.0, and his blog, Rorty Bomb, is indispensable. It was named one of the top 25 best economic and finance blogs by Time Magazine, and he's also a former financial engineer, right? Isn't that right, Mike?
That's true. Financial engineer. I have a business card and everything.
His work has appeared at The American Prospect, NPR's Planet Money, Slate, Atlantic Monthly's Business Channel, and, of course, The Nation. Mike Konzel, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Okay, well, that's a really big question. So what I thought maybe we'd do is let's start with a really simple, straightforward question, which is, what is finance? When we talk about finance, what do we mean? And then what do we want? What is our kind of optimal relationship? What kind of a relationship should there be between finance and what our questioner calls the productive economy?
Sure. So the financial sector does a couple really big things that are important for the real economy. The first thing it does is it handles the payment system, which is, you know, the system of checks, cash, you know, debit cards, credit cards, the way we make payments in exchange for goods and services. The primary thing it does for our purposes is that it handles matching borrowers and lenders. So there are a lot of people and institutions who have money sitting around in, you know, in their metaphoric mattresses, and they want to lend it to people who need to borrow money, who have ideas, who want to expand existing businesses. And the financial sector kind of sits in between them and sits at the nexus where people can kind of, you know, take the money that they already have and put it out there so other people can put it to productive uses.
Right. Just to quickly recap. So the payment system, you know, that's something I think we all experience. And one thing, you know, one of the vectors of development, I would say, in my lifetime is how much easier it's gotten in some ways to pay for stuff. I mean, I remember being a kid and being stuck in Grand Central trying to get back up to the Bronx on the Metro North, and I didn't have enough cash. And I actually had to like ask strangers for cash, right? There was such a time, you know, pre-ATM card when that was the case. But clearly the financial system has done a pretty good job. We can get into the specifics of making it so you can move cash around and pay for stuff, and that lowers transaction costs, helps the real economy.
Right, right. People who are young don't actually know what a traveler's check is anymore, which is probably a good development.
Right, exactly. Yeah, traveler's check. I remember those too. Okay, so then the second thing, the much bigger thing is this, what you call matching up lenders and borrowers, or what I think is more traditionally thought of as channeling savings towards investment. So for the first time in my life, I have a little bit of savings now because I'm not just scraping by, and that money's sitting there and I want to get some return. And so the finance system is going to take that money that's sitting there, and it's going to There's someone out there who either wants to start a business or has an idea for expanding their factory or something like that, or wants to buy a home, and that money's going to get channeled to them.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So that's the relationship that we sort of ideally want to have. Maybe let's step back and say, what kind of role did finance play in terms of its relationship to the real economy from, say, the era of the big New Deal reforms through, say, the 1970s?
Right. So the big things you notice then as compared to now is that there was a lot more activity done that was localized, that you had branch banking. So like, you know, community banks, credit unions, things that weren't mega investment banks did a lot more lending. That was, you know, that was partly the result of regulation. It was partly the result of that there wasn't technology to have international banks. So you saw a much smaller banking sector. What you saw then is that finance was a lot more a partner or an input to a business. So it was almost, it didn't quite run the economy in the way we think post-1980s, where, you know, we'll talk about it in a minute, but something like shareholder value wasn't quite the primary goal of what businesses did. So what you saw back then is that, you know, the real economy, it often financed itself because, you know, the industries in the mid-century period were fairly profitable, you know, and so you saw strong worker gains, and you didn't quite need a really leveraged financial sector to kind of keep these businesses profitable. And you also saw that it was clear that businesses, the CEO and you know, the management, was much more in charge of the relationship between businesses and finance, that it was much more about making sure workers were earning a decent wage, making sure businesses were expanding. It wasn't about, you know, quite as much about the short-term bottom line. They were much more long-term greedy than what we've experienced recently.
Okay, so it seems like there's four big things. One is there's more localism during this period we're talking about from, say, New Deal in 1980 in terms of the way the financial sector operated. So the sort of paradigmatic example of the local bank, it's got savings from local depositors, and then, you know, the guy who lives down the street from the actual lending officer, the banker, comes in and says, I'm going to start a pizza store. And that lending officer, with his knowledge, his local knowledge of the credit worthiness of this guy who's going to start a pizza store and the demand that there might be in the town for pizza, right, makes this kind of judgment about whether to lend or not.
Yes.
And that model is fairly distant now, but was much more dominant in the sort of previous era of finance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's one thing, right? So localism. The other thing is this sort of finance as a means as opposed to an end. So businesses were able to self-finance out of profits a lot more. They were much less leveraged. They were doing lots less of interacting with Wall Street banks to figure out how they can pull off complicated financial moves to goose their profits, and more focused on management as opposed to shareholders, right?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Chris.
And then the third thing you're talking about is sort of the short term versus the long term. So when you're more insulated from Wall Street and finance, you can take a longer view because you're not trying to meet these sort of constant quarterly shareholder expectations.
Exactly.
Okay, so those are sort of some of the features of the kind of, let's say, the golden era, although that's maybe like overly romanticized, of finance and the regular economy. What changes and when does it change?
Well, a lot of things start changing in the early 1980s. There's a wave of financial deregulation that culminates in the late 90s that vastly increases the concentration of the banking sector across the board. So you have, you know, banks could not cross state lines, and that was removed in the early 90s. And so what you see is that we suddenly have a sector that's dominated by five or six banks. You know, we can name them. They're the ones who got in all kinds of trouble during the bailouts. We also see a much greater emphasis on something called the capital markets, which is, for our purposes here, Wall Street. Wall Street's doing a lot more lending in the real economy. So it's not your local bank anymore. It's more international investment banks, you know, Wall Street, you know, the London banks as well. And they exert a disproportionate amount of influence on the way the real economy goes. You see a lot more debt, you know, debt everywhere. You see it on consumers' balance sheets. You see it in businesses. You see debt is kind of almost an ideology where, you know, firms are taken over, hostily using a lot of debt, and then kind of stripped down and sold off for parts. So, you know, debt is almost like a corporate weapon in some ways. You see an emphasis towards something called the Greenspan put. But basically, in terms of the Federal Reserve, in terms of kind of what our money should be doing, it's a lot more about low, stable inflation, and then, you know, always making sure that asset prices are doing pretty well. There's a much more emphasis on how the stock market is doing rather than how unemployment or wages are doing. That's something that's often referred to as the Greenspan put. And there's really the emphasis on shareholder value. So that really comes from the idea that, you know, corporations, which are, you know, they're a socioeconomic creation, like we create them as a democracy through the law. You know, there's a much greater emphasis on short-term growth, mergers, downsizings, having, you know, maybe just three businesses in any market, which is a very common thought in this time period. And, you know, earnings, you know, creative accounting, we'll call it that way to be polite. But the idea that firms exist to make a short-term profit and that anything else it could be doing, either as a kind of entity in the larger country or, you know, even towards a longer term horizon is like a bad idea for it.
So there's this consolidation that happens in the banking sector, thanks largely to deregulation, in which there's a kind of analog to what happened to say, you know, mom and pop hardware stores when Walmart took over, right? You have the sort of economies of scale, massive institutions driving out sort of smaller local ones, actually sometimes just buying them up and consolidating them. And then let's talk a little bit about this kind of shareholder revolution, the ways in which capitalism changes. Let's walk through, let's say, a hypothetical company. I make ice cream cones, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I employ, I got a factory in Maine, let's say, and I employ 500 people making ice cream cones, and I sell them all over the country. And let's say I'm privately held for the moment, right? There's sort of two ways that I can make myself more profitable or make my business better, right? I can like build a better ice cream cone or come up with some efficiencies in my ice cream cone producing method, right? That allows me to push my costs down and increase my profits. Or mm-hmm. I can start to think of ways that I can use finance to kind of essentially play around with the value of the company, right?
Right. The way you could do that is you could, you know, it's technical in practice, but it's a very easy idea. Is you simply take profits you think you will earn in the future and realize them now. And if you don't realize them in the future, if those profits actually didn't happen, then you're screwed. But, you know, you made a bunch of money in the short term and you maybe even got a really nice bonus out of it.
Exactly. And maybe I'm going to only be the CEO of this ice cream company for the short term, in which case this kind of magical profit time travel that finance on Wall Street will allow me to kind of pull off, which is to wrench future profits into the present and cash out on them. Or maybe I'm going to sell my business and rather than putting my energy into the better ice cream code, the more efficient processes, I can consult with a Wall Street bank that figures out a way to kind of use the financial markets to pull off this time travel and wrench these profits forward, and then I sell the company and I bag it, right?
Exactly. And another thing that they would suggest you do is that it says, well, instead of making a better ice cream cone, why don't you just keep buying out your competitors? We'll give you lots of debt to do that. Mm. And either you'll really, you know, corner the market or you won't, and then you'll be saddled with all these debt payments you can't make. So there's also that real urgency towards consolidation and really growth through mergers, growth through, you know, trying to buy out the weakest competitor and going forward that way.
Oh, that's an interesting. So those two trends that we've seen, we had Barry Lynn on the podcast before, who wrote a great book about the rise of monopoly capitalism called Cornered. The rise of monopoly capitalism and the financialization of the economy, you're saying go hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Barry's actually really good on a company called GE, which everyone knows, which was a real financial company by the time it imploded during the bailouts. But Jack Welch was very, very confident on the idea that there should only be three businesses in any market. So, you know, that's why, though there's a lot of different types of Coca-Cola cans when you go to the supermarket, there's essentially only three companies that make them.
So you mentioned GE, and GE is probably the best single example of this transformation. It's a company I think a lot of us still think of as like sort of classic American industrial company. They make light bulbs, which all of us have in our house. That's their insignia to this day, right? Is the light bulb.
Right.
They make real stuff that has real value and they sell it and they produce it for a cost and they sell it above that cost and they take the profit and that's what they do. But that's not really what they do so much anymore. Tell me a little bit about the transformation of GE.
So GE always had this subsidiary called GE Capital. It was a division of GE. And in the 30s, it was kind of like small banking. It was all about providing loans to mom-and-pa businesses so that they could buy GE refrigerators to sell on a Main Street storefront.
It was like the credit division of your local car lot, right? It was the credit was there so that you could buy their product.
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, the idea that there was four storefronts and then consumers could come and buy their light bulbs and whatnot. And then it changed in the 60s to this kind of much more consultancy world of you have these large kind of, you know, Fordist-Kensian corporations, as we call them. And, you know, they provided consulting services to them about their books and how to manage and how to expand their businesses. But by the time you got to Jack Welch, by the time you got to the 1980s, it got much more into the financial sector. And basically, it took money that it had from GE products, and instead of reinvesting them in higher wages or, you know, more innovative products or expanded businesses, they started lending them out in the capital markets as if they were an investment bank. And what's actually really surprising is that by the time it got to 2008, GE was one of the top subprime lenders through its subsidiaries. Now, it's a very complicated corporate chart, but GE was behind some of the major imploding subprime lenders who were going, you know, door-to-door finding widows to, you know, they'd go through the newspapers and find widows and try to sell them really bad loans. You know, that was ultimately backstopped with GE money. And when that whole chain collapsed, you know, GE had to receive huge amounts of bailouts.
And the fascinating thing is that this shift happens somewhat slowly, but it also happens in the respect where you have like, it's like you're sitting on this company and you've got part of it that does all this old real economy stuff. It builds engines for planes. It makes light bulbs. And the return there is fine, but not incredible. And then you're sitting on this pool of capital and you can use that pool of capital to get returns that are 2, 3, 4 times what you're getting actually making stuff. So it's not rocket science, right?
Right.
To chase the returns in the financial markets.
And what's funny is that the ratings agencies, which deserve their own many podcasts and books, they'd look at GE and they'd say, well, you know, this is a solid industrial business. It's, you know, GE light bulbs are not going to collapse overnight. We should give this a AAA solid rating. And the thing is that GE could take that solid rating and for a whole variety of regulatory and informational things, it could then be a very solidly rated bank, even though it wasn't. It was this real fly-by-night kind of really leveraged thing that a hedge fund essentially that imploded. But it kind of blurred the lines. And the regulatory apparatus we have that distinguishes between the real economy and the financial economy was purposely blurred there to basically to kind of bad ends, as we found out.
So it could kind of arbitrage its industrial reputation to set up a really highly leveraged bank arm.
Exactly, yeah. The regulatory arbitrage is exactly the phrase for it.
And so there's a lot of other things that happen during this period too, in terms of financialization. A huge part is that economies all over the world open up, and when they open up, their savings and capital and profits get poured into this global financial capital markets that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and grows, I mean, doubles, right, between 2000 and 2008, I think, the amount of money in global financial markets. We've now had this crash. What are the ways that we can recalibrate a healthier relationship between the financial economy and the regular economy? And getting back to Jacob D's question, is it the case that we are sort of held hostage? And if so, how do we get out of that situation?
So one thing to remember is that post-1980, growth is slower. It's more stable, and there's reasons why that might be, but it's slower. So it's not clear that we got this great deal for financializing our economy in the way we have. We do know that, you know, finance is attracting a huge amount of our attention. It's attracting a huge amount of our most skilled and talented people. And it's, you know, it's so profitable in a way that's creating all kinds of political problems where we don't know, you know, where the government ends and the financial sector begins. So, I mean, it is a challenge, and it's not clear we're getting this huge trade-off for it. So what's the right way to go about this? One is to try to re-emphasize localism. Try to reemphasize the notion that really big banks are not helping us. Dodd-Frank and some other measures are trying to help with that by basically requiring larger banks to hold more capital and be less leveraged and be safer. That's going to be a very difficult battle in practice, and we're going to see how that happens over the next couple of years. Part of it needs to also be a cultural change. I mean, up until this point, the financial sector was seen as a very cutting-edge and innovative sector, where now people kind of think it was maybe all just kind of a Ponzi scheme, you know, built on huge amounts of debt and hoping that a housing bubble wouldn't explode. So de-emphasizing the cultural prestige of Wall Street and investment banks and finance is something that will be important. I mean, it's hard to do in practice because it's very profitable and it has a huge amount of power, and that's going to attract a lot of people and attention. But, you know, these things don't happen overnight.
Are there radical solutions out there to this problem? I think about the payment system, for instance. Why couldn't the government just handle the payment system? I mean, maybe that sounds like crude Marxism, but...
No. So this is an important point. We need to reemphasize the government as a counterweight to the financial sector. So Senator Levin just released this huge report about fraud in Wall Street last week. And, you know, they went and talked to the Office of Thrift Supervision, which is a very prominent banking regulator, and they themselves thought of the banks they regulated as clients, like they were providing some sort of service as opposed to some sort of actual, like, policing function check on what kind of shenanigans can go on. So it's important to reemphasize that the government needs to be a check here. The government can do things. I mean, it has powers. You know, J.P. Morgan's making this big deal about a bunch of reforms, saying that, you know, if you try to regulate us, we're going to stop services for poor people. And that's really going to screw up the Democrats and liberals, because they want services for poor people. And then you look at it and say, well, the government can do this. The government used to run something called postal banks pre-New Deal, which, you know, a lot of new immigrants were very accustomed to having banking run through postal services, through the post office by the government. We can do something like that. We can give people a place to cash a check safe that, you know, doesn't charge them usurious fees or anything like that. So, I mean, we need to reemphasize that the government has powers here and it can function as a check.
Mike Konzel is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. He blogs at New Deal 2.0, and his blog, Rorty Bomb, is absolutely indispensable for following all things about finance and the political economy of finance. Mike, it's been so great to have you on The Breakdown.
Thanks for having me.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation magazine and TheNation.com. New audiocasts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available on iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Ryan Rafferty and yours truly. Senior producers of The Nation are Frank Reynolds and Emily Douglas. Questions, comments, and feedback should be sent to TheBreakdown@TheNation.com.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to?